Hey, everybody, check this out. At the end of this episode, don't go away. I begged, I pleaded, and HarperCollins Audio agreed to let me include a section to start the prologue in the first chapter of my new book, Blackfall. So you'll get the intro, you get the wonderful Jennifer O'Donnell's introduction to that, and everything else. So check that out. That's just following. All you don't have to do is just sit right here. Don't do anything.
Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Well, good day, sirs.
Gentlemen, I'm a little breathless here.
I believe it. It's been a big week.
Trying to calm down. No, I got a thing. I'm gonna show this to your eyeballs, and you're gonna see this. And you know, for a long time we've been covering a topic here, and maybe we've been the laughingstock of the media if they ever cared to pay attention. The rest of the world, the scientific communities turned their back on us, and here we've been shunned as we have been the one group that's intrepidly reported on this phenomenon, this cryptozoological thing that could be both supernatural, everything, whatever. We're the ones been bringing this story to you week after week, much to the abuse of our colleagues and peers, mostly imagined in our heads.
Goblins. Did somebody just say goblins?
I didn't say goblins.
I mean, I just said goblins twice when I asked you.
Other than you saying goblins.
Oh, yeah.
Did you say goblins?
I heard a goblin. Do I hear a goblin? We have one goblin. Do I hear two goblins?
Goblin.
I'm going to give you one goblin, but how would you like to see? Headline is: kids have a kickabout flee in terror after a goblin sneaks up on their pitch, and it's called That's Orkward from the
Orkward? They did a pun?
Here's the video. Watch. Kids, these are in Argentina. Argentina kids. Goblins are spreading. Look in the background.
Having a kickabout is also a thing.
Okay, there's a...
Okay, this thing, for the audio listeners, what you see is a bunch of kids, and they are indeed having a kickabout.
Playing footy.
Yeah.
They're on the pitch. Life's a pitch, after all.
A drunk, undecided dog that keeps pivoting left and then right.
Oh, like Brian, why are you so quick to just prejudice everybody with what a drunk dog? Yes.
Obviously a soccer concerned goblin.
Yeah, the title says goblin, Brian. What information do you have?
No, I'm just saying I am just
and that goblin, saying. I mean, it might be sick, it might be dehydrated, but it is lurching toward these kids just looking to get in on the game.
Left and right. It just keeps falling one side to the
Noted
other.
Noted goblin ambulatory expert Brian Brushwood.
I mean, I do co-host one of the number one goblin concerned podcasts on the internet.
Yes. As a goblin concerned citizen, I have the following questions. Number one, I wish that we would have been able to get... You know, you always run toward the story, kid with the camera. This is not, sure, he's probably a youngster, but you just wish you would have gotten a little bit of a better look at this example of goblindom.
First of all, I think we're all GCCs here. We're all goblin concerned citizens. And so none of us are into goblin shaming, accusations of goblinness.
I wish to be identified as a GC.
A GC?
Yeah, I'm goblin concerned.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You know what? I'll get the tattoo as well. So what's beautiful about this video is that nowadays what it seems like we are actively seeking is unclear video that we can project interesting, terrifying things onto, right?
By the way, if you want to identify yourself as Goblin Concerned, like, what kind of ribbon should we have? And should it be burnt at the edges or something?
It's got to be green, and it's four strips of green ribbon in a hashtag symbol. So that you know,
green ribbon in a hashtag. GC.
Yeah, Goblin Concerned.
You want to know what? I'm going to go ahead and say maybe multiple angles of anything that could be jostled might not be the best idea.
Yeah, but like a black or green ribbon just tied up in a weird knot that you just sort of have to look at and go, what is that?
Black,
like,
it's and a green. Yeah, I guarantee you there's no black and green ribbon. So black and green means you're GC.
Meanwhile, gentlemen, in other news, Jeff Bezos, who has started a little startup called Amazon, you may have heard of.
Yeah.
Is kind of really excited about the space thing. And today he unloaded some photos of his the new rocket systems, the new rockets that they're going to be using to power both the rocket they want to do, which is going to be the new Glenn, which he, you know, released. There's a photo, I think, down at the bottom there. You can see this. I think this is the BE-4 rocket engines, which is designed to replace our reliance on Russian rocket boosters. And so it's going to power also the Vulcan, but also the Blue Origin new Shepard rocket. Excuse me, the new Glenn rocket. So see if you can pull up the photo of that, Bryce. Remember the he was pointing out the size differences between his rocket. There we go.
There we go.
So let's get a little bit of a description here, what we're looking at.
So right now we are seeing an escalating size comparison beginning at the Antares rocket and ending at the Saturn V. But more notably is, the Soyuz rockets, which are currently our cheapest way to get into space. In the mid-tier, we have the
Falcon 9. Sorry.
What was that?
Cheapest is Falcon 9.
Okay, sorry. Pre-private space flight, you know, what people might have heard the Soyuz name before is all I was trying to point out. Falcon 9, Falcon Heavy, Delta 4 Heavy, which are all SpaceX rockets.
Well, Delta 4 Heavy.
Not the Delta 4. Sorry, Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy.
You're just not good at this, Justin. I'm sorry.
Hey, why don't you go ahead and do it yourself?
Yes, we have the Antares rocket. Then we do have the Soyuz, which is still currently used. It's how we currently put our astronauts on the space station, renting seats from the Russians. Then the Ariane 5, the Atlas 5, the Vulcan, and then the Falcon 9, the Falcon Heavy, which may launch this summer, we hope. The Delta IV Heavy, which is a nice big brutish rocket, one of our big power lifters here. And then showing us how much bigger is the two-stage new Glenn that Blue Origin wants to build, and that's what the engines are going to be for. I think there's going to be like 7 in the core for that. And then next to that's the three-stage new Glenn, which is bigger. And all of these, the three stages, almost as tall as the Saturn V, minus the, like, what would have been the lunar module section right on top. And then they show just how big the landed booster is. So they're building engines. They're going to start testing it. He promises to have the new Glenn. Well, it says he's not promises. It says they're going to try to have the new Glenn launched by the end of the decade.
So there is a parallel that once I saw it, I've not been able to unsee. You guys are familiar with the good old Marvel Comics, Fantastic Four, Reed Richards, and Doctor Doom relationship, right? Two brilliant people for very different reasons. One has an empire that he rules over but wants to be respected as a scientist. The other one, just everything he says is electric and everybody falls in love with it immediately. I can't stop thinking of Jeff Bezos as Dr. Doom, as somebody who's like, I'm really doing science, guys. I'm doing the hard. Yes, well, I am a dictator of an empire, but I'm making a robot that is going to fly.
There was an article over this weekend, and it was Washington Post, which is the newspaper he owns, which talks about the ambitious plans that Blue Origin has to try to do regular routine service to the moon. They want to start doing delivery service to putting payloads and stuff there. And if you go to the Washington Post version of the article, which is always sort of like, if you click through the link there, you'll see the file photo that they always use of him versus the one we just saw.
Yes, I have been.
Look at that. Jeff Bezos with glasses on in front of the Blue Origin rocket in full cool guys don't look at explosions glare looking to off camera.
Do you think there's some unfair like cultural projections that we're making where am I the only one who feels like Jeff Bezos is the sympathetic yet also haunted by who he is Dr. Doom figure in this scenario?
I think whenever you get to categorizing somebody as Dr. Doom, no matter how much you can look into, the comparisons you're making are not irrelevant. I can see where you're coming from. However, I think there is just a pause whenever you're like, anyway, so he's the masked vein dictator, and the other guy is,
I think that's what I love about this parallel is he's also truly visionary, truly gifted, truly brilliant, but just not good at PR. And then meanwhile, you've got cool guy, silver templed, just Robert Young looking Reed Richards, who's just like, I don't know, let's dig holes under L.A. And everyone cheers instantly. And then meanwhile, Jeff Bezos is slamming his fist on the computer saying, why do they all love him? I don't understand.
I'm sure that there is in any when you're in the billionaire club, there is probably a tremendous amount of measuring and competition and comparisons between each other and whatnot that goes on there. But I mean, Bezos is one of the richest men in the world. I mean, literally, like, and Blue Origin's a hobby for him, basically. It's just he's kind of doing this out of his own pocket change sort of thing. They've gotten some government grants now, but $73.3 billion. Okay, he's almost within, he's more than Zuckerberg. He's within the couple billion dollar fluctuation within Warren Buffett, and he could surpass Bill Gates. Bezos may possibly become the richest man in the world by the end of the decade.
All right, my thesis is not we should shed a tear for him. My thesis is now that I've seen this comparison of somebody who everything he said, the whole world goes nuts over, and somebody else who is doing every bit as good of work, but because
I don't see that though. I see that his company's in a very different stage. Is that he's not putting up orbital rockets yet. He's not doing that. So I think that he's like, yeah, I'm doing space too, but I don't think he's there thinking, well, my suborbital is just as good as orbital. I think, you know, I think he wants to say, hey, I'm doing cool stuff too, but I don't think he's saying my achievements are on par with SpaceX.
Because we also don't know for Blue Origin exactly how much stuff has even like blown up, right? Like they haven't done a live launch in the same way that SpaceX has. They've done awesome YouTube videos, but who knows where in the process that is? I guess that's the biggest
thing. I mean, because they have to file with FAA and stuff like when they've had, you know, when they've done some of the bigger stuff like that. If they had a test stand explosion, we would know. If they'd cratered something, we would know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all I know is that I'm very grateful for the Latverian health insurance that I receive. So,
whoops, and the discussion's over.
Well, but it did do so now. But Bezos is now announcing that they're going to with Blue Origin. They want to do routine service to the moon with cargo delivery and stuff,
which is rad. I mean, I think that's like, you know, there is nothing more exciting. The only thing more exciting than SpaceX doing what they're doing is Blue Origin also doing amazing things, right? Because this is not, if we really want to talk about expanding into space and becoming a truly off-planet, human experiment, that doesn't happen with one company. It happens with many, many companies, and it happens with, governments pouring money in to making this a reality as well. So I would hope that there is, as much as Brian, I think I can see where you're coming from. There's going to be plenty of room for everybody. You know, the space is really, really, really big. And I can only hope that this continues to be a bigger priority for both companies as they both succeed.
Yeah. And certainly that is absolutely our hope and intention. But I'd like once you start seeing things a certain way, it's hard to. All you do is find more and more parallels.
So no observations or comments on the moon delivery service.
Well, I mean, okay, first of all, there is no moon delivery service. There's a bunch of words were spoken. They're great words. They're the best words. I really look forward to them becoming a thing.
Until then, no discussion. It's over.
No, 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 no. Until then, I want to talk about Dr. Doom. How about that?
He's got X-Men on the brain.
Sorry. Little bit.
All right. Moving right along.
Where do you see, where does this fit in to the kind of greater goals for both Blue Origin and SpaceX? All of a sudden, the moon is this hot thing.
We've been hinting at the fact that we're hearing rumors that within the current administration, there is going to be maybe some big space initiative, possibly returning to the moon, et cetera. And now we have both NASA had put out a call to look into the research of sending the Orion craft on board the SLS to do a lunar orbit. SpaceX, as we talked about over a week ago, announced that they're going to be sending a craft around the moon. Their plan is next year. We'll see if they make that. And then now we have Blue Origin saying, yes, we're going to begin a service doing regular deliveries to the moon. And Bezos is very, very big on this. And this is a man worth $75 billion. This is a man worth the entire amount of money spent on the Apollo program. This is a man who could fund the manned exploration part of NASA, could fund that by himself solely for 25 years at government prices.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he's like, hey, he said his most important life mission is millions of people working in space. And so if it's Joe Nobody saying this, it's one thing. But when it's a leader of one of the largest corporations in the world and one of the richest men in the world who said this is his mission, is like, and yes, we're going to be doing a moon delivery service. It's like, that's a little bit more than a paper rocket to me.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I wonder what the next step is that we can gauge how far along and how fast Blue Origin is moving. I guess that's my only question.
Yeah, I mean, the goal is they want to try to launch the New Glenn by the end of the decade, which means, you know, that's either by, you know, technically 2020, you know, which that's their goal, to get their big, huge rocket up there going by then. So, you know, it's going to be a very interesting time, because if everybody's schedule goes according to plan, which statistically speaking won't, but just assuming everybody's timelines between the government with the SLS, SpaceX with Falcon Heavy, and Blue Origin with the new Glenn, that means by the end of the decade, we'll have three heavy lift rockets. We've never had that kind of capability before. And then both Blue Origin's hinted at New Armstrong. SpaceX is working on the ITS, or the Big Falcon Rocket, as its nickname is now. And, you know, we've heard rumblings about there may be some design changes in that to make it even more shorter term or something. So
what about other countries? I mean, obviously, we're all American here, so we unfortunately tend to be American-centric.
Unfortunate for you, Brian.
Well, if we were better people, we would pay attention to more other countries, is all I'm saying. Does America have – I assume not. Does America have a monopoly on heavy lift rockets, and we got three different types?
Well, there's – You have as far as the area of doing that, you have the Ariane rockets would be the European, okay, would be so that's the European system. You know, the Russians have been using the Soyuz mainly for what they've been doing. And as far as larger heavy lift rockets, there's not been the last real heavy lift big in that kind of category rocket would have been like the Inertia, which they used the Soviet era, they used for the Buran. And I think they only flew like twice.
The Buran was their space shuttle.
What's that? Yeah. That was their version of that. So Inertia would have been sort of like the last major one. So other than that, you know, there's talk, you know, among, you know, between the Europeans doing stuff, the Chinese are working on building a larger, heavier lift rocket. So there is a goal towards doing that for sure.
Did you see the story about China no longer buying coal from North Korea? Like, I don't know how much of this was bluff and bluster PR stuff, which China certainly has a reputation for doing. But they coal is North Korea's, as according to the articles, their number one export, and China, their number one customer. And meanwhile, you know, China, oftentimes whenever you look at Reddit, it's being hailed for, I don't know, embracing green energy or clean energy and so on.
It's a joke, but it's a PR move entirely.
So are there, like, are they faking all this? Like North Korea is still going to sell them coal? Like, I'm less interested in why China would do it because, you know, they're China, right? But I am more interested in, even if it's only as a PR stunt, like, that's going to have real, very significant ramifications.
Are they trying to punish North Korea or whatever for not kind of... You know, China's been sort of North Korea's biggest sponsor, but I think that, you know, China has their own kind of limits to patience with North Korea, and that may be a reaction to that. As far as the whole Chinese green initiatives, you need to read more deeply into that. That is a complete PR move. That's all that is. They are continuing to build and expand. I totally
assume that was the case, but
yeah, gambling, you know, man, if that's your hope, we're screwed. It is you've fallen for a line.
For those not watching, a gambling man in the chat wrote, "It's up to China to save the planet," which is the inspiration for Andrew's one-sided outburst.
I love. I was going to follow that up with that. I've had a wonderful time visiting wonderful, wonderful people. But if you're looking for this single party, you know, collectivist system that's the most corrupt business meritocracy, or, you know, ain't gonna happen.
So what does this mean for North Korea? Because North Korea, last time I checked, they weren't exactly rolling in the dough, and they weren't the most popular guys on the global stage.
I'm not an expert on, you know, Pacific relations, but I would suspect that, I mean, there was also the story this week about the missile test that North Korea did that has raised tensions with Japan. And I assume if China does not feel that they are sufficiently in the loop or does not feel that their military aims are aligned, then they will punish them with the biggest stick they have, which is, you know,
Stop buying their number one export. Yeah. Okay. All right. That gives some good context.
That's what I would you know, guess. Also, it seems like stuff is just getting wild in North Korea right now. Like, you know, the brother got, you know, killed in some, you know, chemical attack, and
Hired on Fiverr, basically.
Yeah. Did you hear about that, Brian?
No. Wait. What?
The brother
wasn't really on
Fiverr,
but felt like it.
Brother of Kim Jong Un.
I did hear that Kim Jong Un had a relative that died, and it was significant. That's all.
So
I know.
He was the brother that got passed over that put Kim Jong Un in position to take over
what?
The country.
What?
And he's just walking in an airport. Two ladies smear stuff on his face.
One sprays him. The other one puts a cloth over his face. One lady is wearing a shirt that says LOL.
Dead at the airport.
Wait, she was wearing a shirt that said LOL? That's the most tragic part to me.
She was a Malaysian, or she was a YouTuber.
Yep.
And apparently she said she got hired as a prank, was given the substance, didn't know it was actually going to kill him.
My God.
It was a prank.
Oh, my God.
It's
just a prank, bro.
It's a social experiment of what happens to the sociopolitical landscape when you murder the brother of a oligarch. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So that's number one on the top 10 hilarious prank fails coming out this week on YouTube. So wait, there's video of the actual
YouTube
assassination?
CCTV picked up footage of it.
So this is him going to security and complaining that had happened.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so I owe an apology to Joss Whedon, who wrote... he wrote a big chunk of Alien 3, right?
I think he wrote the original draft to Alien 3.
Or am I thinking of Alien Resurrection? I know he did Alien Resurrection, but at any rate, one of the things in Alien 3 that was surely intended as social commentary at the time was you have four soldiers and there's a fifth guy without a gun who's only holding a camera. And it was very clear, like, at the time, it's like, well, it's insane to think that you know, a camera would be that important that they would dedicate another man rather than, you know, give him a camera instead of a gun We live in that world now where all of this will be documented. And the whole world will watch. That's very weird.
But we still won't know anything.
Correct. Oh. We'll only know whatever people choose to tell us. Yeah.
Also, Brian, how many have you gotten? Are you going to look twice at all these emails that come in, you know, on the basis of your successful YouTube show? Just like, hey, here's a prank thing that we're going to do. It's like, man, I don't know. I'm going to look twice at that.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit. I'm not going to.
Are you or have you ever been in touch with the North Korean government? Just in all caps, responding to every business email.
It's funny is that we have this, like, I have no problem with surveillance cameras, whatever, in public, because we don't have an assumption of privacy when we're a public and all that. And it's sort of funny where you'll see kind of a people criticizing that or whatever. And then you get an ad for like the new Google Home thing. You know, like,
yeah, that's a weird part, right?
I don't government treating my privacy. Meanwhile, here's this device that's always next to me that can listen in on everything that I've just welcomed with open arms into my home.
I mean, it's like I right now, I will bet $1 that whoever is listening to this, there is a microphone capable of listening to you right this very second.
Like, I don't know. Where would the mic be? Like, yeah. Around right
really
now.
Brian. Really, Brian.
I'm not talking to you guys. I'm talking to the folks at home. Right. I mean, first of all, if they're listening to this, then that is definitely on a device that can't be compromised. So
well,
crazy.
I think it's funny because there was a photo of Zuckerberg at his desk, and they pointed out that he put a Post-it note over the camera on his Mac.
Do you think that is a testament to how pervasive governmental snooping is, or a testament to how important a target he feels like he is? Because agreed. Yes. If I was Mark Zuckerberg, I'd put Post-it notes over everybody's eyes when they walked into the office, you know, but absent that, like, if you're just not a very interesting target, is that something you should worry about?
Well, I mean, it's not just the government. I mean, it's more, you know, the third party actors and stuff are involved in doing that now, too. And you're getting all sorts of weird, you know, Bitcoin, like, you know, I talked about before, like the problem. I think Bitcoin's a great concept. The problem with Bitcoin is it makes all sorts of online fraud and extortion much, much easier to do now. That's not an excuse not to have it. Let me make that very, very clear. But it's the rise of those things. So you're seeing now, like, you want your files back? Give us Bitcoin. We're going to see that, oh, we have 3 hours of you in your eyesight camera and you're naked, you know? Pay us.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, our friend Darren Kitchen, who obviously is well-versed in the world of exploits and your vulnerability, and you and your data's vulnerability is always a little bit more dubious on exactly how much you should care about covering up your camera. But at the same time, I don't know. If I was Zuckerberg, absolutely. I'd cover everything. You know.
I mean, I think that's one.
That guy's going to run for president in 2 years. You know.
Is that a thing? Is there word on the street about that?
I mean, he will be of age to do it by the time that the next election happens, and he seems there's you know some
there was internally at Facebook they did some analysis to understand what would be the impact if he decided to run for president or had political ambitions. They'd asked, you know, there was a turn to like, well, if he decided to run, what would that mean for Facebook, etc.
Wow. Well, here's what I suspect. I suspect that that the awareness of how much glass there is around your house and how a brick can fly through glass very, very easily, makes you think, well, do I want to get the triple reinforced glass, maybe put up blast shields or whatever? And it's like, you know, ultimately that doesn't matter if you live in a relatively happy, affluent area where there are no shortages or scarcity at the time. Does that make sense? So by which I mean, you are not a very interesting target. As long as you're not an interesting target, I would hope that that your risk of, you know, anyone peeping on you would be lower.
Yeah, it's just becoming so easier now to run, you know, these bot network exploits and stuff. Is that one of the things that happens now is, like, when they steal credit card data, like credit card and social security information, they'll sit on it for a long time, right?
Yeah.
And there's also, like, there are far more exploits that happen that get announced too. I mean, that's the other thing, is that legally you're supposed to announce it, but there are companies that will weigh in, and their IT people that get together and they'll be like, we're just not going to say anything, and we'll give you a severance, you take off and whatever. That happens way more often. One thing is they sit on that. So it's like we give you an example of, there was an item that made the news, and it was not reported accurately, but it was that, initial story was hotel ransomed by hackers as guests locked out of rooms, right? And this was the story that made it around the world, which was that some hackers got hold of the electronic door system in a hotel and then locked everybody out until they paid a ransom, which was not really what happened. Guests weren't actually locked out of the room, but what they did do is that they did shut down the system that allowed new keys to be made. So basically what they did is they shut down, you know, this hotel. Like, if you wanted to get a room, you couldn't do it. And so it was like, you've got to pay this. These things happen a lot. These kind of, like, you know, it was like $1,600 things. And a lot of times these things happen and nobody reports them.
Right. Yeah. So this is basically the cybersecurity version of a mugging, right? Where it's like, or extortion, or just, you know, give me $20 or I'm going to poke this knife into your lady or whatever.
Yeah. And so these are things that we only hear.
Hey, mister, give me $20 or I'm going to poke this knife into your lady.
Or whatever.
Or whatever.
I'm going to rub you with this bullet.
These things are happening more and more, and there's a lot of reason to believe that major corporations, Fortune 500 companies, have been falling prey to these things very frequently, but they don't want to report on these vulnerabilities and stuff. And so that, because one of the things they can do is they can go and they can just encrypt your system and maybe never even steal your data, but prevent you from getting your data, right?
Right. Yeah.
And say, all right, if you want the key, give us this amount of money. And if you're a financial institution, you don't want to report this. You know, right. You don't want to do this. And we found numerous instances too of companies, like, remember Yahoo got hacked and Yahoo didn't tell us.
Yeah. There's apparently it happens
Yahoo
a lot.
Was in the middle of finalizing their deal with Verizon, which wound up, you know, becoming a little mini cover up for them, which wound up knocking quite a bit off the price tag of what Verizon was willing to pay for Yahoo.
Yeah, they apparently it happens a lot to hospitals, because those are crucial, up to the minute, life and death situations that if they get, you know, like, ransomware is a scary ass thing. And especially, you think to yourself, like, well, I'll never go to those sites. It's not you have to be worried about. It is your children, your inexperienced young ones who are surfing on the web or whatever. Like, there's. Our family photos are on a network attached storage, a Synology disk station or whatever. And it's like, I bought a extra drive just so I could get them physically off of that and have a backup that's in a safe, so that if we ever got hit by a ransomware attack, this is a little bit specific. I probably shouldn't have been this specific in this conversation just now.
What's the port that you used?
It's 192.168. Mm-hmm.
Which room in the house
connected to a Wi-Fi
drive
network?
Well, okay, so you're going to drive it. The gate code is.
Oh, God, don't do that, please.
No, but it's one of those things, like we live in a world where these are things you have to consider. Like, what do you truly care about? What is the worst thing that very realistically could happen to it? And how do you want to be prepared to have leverage if and when that happens?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a scary world. Very scary world. This is why we need your support, because we're scared.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We have to hire security, and the only way to do it is for you to go to patreon.com/weirdthings, where you could support the show directly. All right, Bryce, show me. Have we? Are we? Oh, dang it! We slipped.
We're under 500.
Under 500, and more importantly, we are 19 away from Yolo 420. Blaze it!
I know. Well, this is the beginning of the beginning of the month. Right?
Beginning of the month. There's always a slippage then. If you're on the fence and you've been considering, I don't know, maybe keeping us on the regular, giving us a few shekels to keep this thing possible, Bryce is very, very hungry, and we really would love to continue to feed him. And you could make that possible by going to patreon.com/weirdthings.
I need food.
Appreciate it.
He's moaning again because of the dysentery. Because the only food he's eaten has been from the gutter.
Garbage food.
Garbage.
We have been feeding Bryce garbage, by the way. That turns out was not a smart decision.
But check it out on Modern Rogue tomorrow. It's a really good episode.
Here's how to eat for free.
Thank you, guys.
I got one more bit of science before we do the other thing. Yeah. And this is really cool. There's a paper that just, or a proposal that's being proposed by some proposees. Mm-hmm. Some NASA scientists have said that if you put a large electromagnet of one or two Teslas in strength at a Lagrange point in front of Mars, one of the Martian Lagrange points between Mars and the sun, but just far enough out, it can create an artificial magnetic shield which would block the solar winds and help protect you from radiation.
Oh, this is interesting. Mm-hmm. First of all, when you say one to two Teslas in strength, are you talking about the automobile or a...
Yes, Brian. You just need to put the cars out there. They've got a lot of features.
I am unfamiliar with the unit Tesla as a unit of measurement. Is there a
context?
It's
like 20,000 Gauss or something like that, I think.
Two thoughts on this. Number one, this is really interesting because we've talked and thought about this in the context of the earlier you identify an asteroid on its way to Earth, the less you need to do to make sure it doesn't end up hitting Earth. I had never considered that in the context of solar winds and cosmic radiation. That's a really interesting idea. Separate from that, I've heard that the reason, that one of the naysaying tropes for terraforming Mars is they say, there's no liquid core, there's no magnetic field. Even if you make it into an Earth, it will, eventually that atmosphere will just blow away in the cosmic winds. And I believe what I had heard is like, look, if you have the energy resources to make Mars into a livable place, then you certainly have the resources to bother to do maintenance on it. Like, yes, those solar winds are going to blow some stuff away. You'll have to bother to chuck an aero-braked comet from now and then. But outside of that, that's not a valid complaint.
So, and what's interesting is, so somebody points out, like, some of your MRI machines could be a couple Teslas, but that's only for like a fraction of a second. This would have to be a continuous output. But so we can... It's a scalable technology now. Put a bunch of solar panels there, whatever, power this thing. We can conceive of a way to do that. And what this means, though, is if once you're stopping those solar winds and you're able to minimize the amount of radiation hitting the surface, one, makes it easier for people to walk around and not worry about, dying of radiation. There's still cosmic background radiation. But the other thing is the scientists say that, hey, if we build this artificial magnetosphere around Mars, what will happen is – the natural outgassing we already have of CO2 and whatnot coming from the planet that's getting stripped away could help us build an atmosphere there. And we could, and what they're saying, maybe within decades.
Wow.
Noticeably thicken the atmosphere.
Wow.
So much so.
And help that, melt the ice caps.
Yeah, they could restore Mars's oceans to some degree.
Wow. So, man, that's fascinating. I mean, really, is there any practical application for this trick of science outside of protecting Mars?
The moon.
Oh, my God. That's the weird one. That's the one I can't wrap my mind around. When we talk about, throw atmosphere on the moon. Why not? Go for it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. And now that we got it, right, let's just throw an atmosphere on it.
She's a bit of a fixer-upper.
I love the idea of terraforming the moon. And now that one of the things they talked about is eventually you would lose your atmosphere, but it would be a very gradual process. But if you have this ability here to do that, and then, the moon is there's certain things that were going to be missing on the moon. I think carbon is one of those things. But nonetheless, the idea of like steering, comets into the moon. It's kind of cool, but I love the idea of terraforming the moon. Frankly, I just like the idea of us looking up and seeing a green thing right up there.
Well, and so
how rad would that be?
Okay. So I know we visited this before, but I want to go back there again. So,
Dr. Doom. So he's not Dr. Doom. Go ahead.
I mean, look, that's fine. New Latveria is my new favorite body in the solar system. If you're comparing terraforming, and I can't believe I'm using these words, terraforming the moon to terraforming Mars, the two things that pop into my mind is, one, Mars is so far away that there's an insane amount of energy that it takes to get out there, and the supply chain is so difficult. The moon is only 2.5-3 days away, and it definitely receives exactly the same amount of energy as planet Earth. So, but with that lighter gravity, you're going to have to get like a ridiculous amount of air to get the same air pressure, right?
As far as how, no, I don't, I remember, I'm trying to remember like what the amount of air or whatever you would need to be able to do that. I forget that. Cause like you can, you know, at depth, I'm trying to remember the statistics on that. I remember I read the paper on that, but, you know, listen, man, why quibble?
I'm not trying to poke holes in anything. I mean, excited about it. It's a new set of things to grapple with.
A lot less surface area too, though. So I don't know. You know, I think that's much less surface area. So I don't know relatively what you need to do on that. But you know, it's a.
Oh, I'm just trying to picture. I guess the atmospheric profile would look different because you would have to have at 1/6 the gravity. You would have to have, I would imagine, 6 times the atmosphere to get us to 14 pounds per square inch.
I don't think it works like that linearly.
Okay. Huh. All right. Yeah. Okay. Look, man, I know my limits. I know when I've hit the end of my math.
I don't know. So I don't know. I'm not sure how much you would need to be able to do there and what you would be able to do. But I mean, I think it's just a fascinating idea that we could build a magnetosphere around the moon and what happens there.
Well,
you know.
And that is so close. Well, and plus also for the record, the moon. No. The dark side of the moon does it. It's not helio, whatever, locked, tidally locked. It's tidally locked for us. Sorry, for a brief second, I was thinking you wouldn't even need a magnetic shield because one side would always be away from the moon. But I'm thinking of Mercury or something else.
Yeah, Mercury appears to be tidally locked.
Yeah,
or roughly. Yeah. And that's like all of the new planets they discovered around TRAPPIST are all tidally locked.
Man.
We assume they are. So just interesting, there's a history of different sort of bases on the moon. These included Project Horizon, a plan by the Army to build a fort on the moon by 1967. The U.S. Air Force proposed the LUNEX project. And that was a point where they were thinking that, oh, you know, we go to the moon because it would be really, you know, that you could build have your launch missiles and stuff from there and all that. But then it realized, nah, you just put them in orbit. Because even getting to the moon, it's still not that, you know, somebody asked us to discuss like, oh, why doesn't SpaceX, like with their lunar project, why don't they just drop some cargo on the moon? The problem is the velocity is that the SpaceX, the lunar pass, it's not even in orbit. It's going by really, really fast. It's not leaving Earth orbit. It's leaving low Earth orbit, but it's not going to be leaving Earth orbit. It's just like throwing a rock really far out, and it's going to loop around the moon and come back to Earth, but it's not going to enter into a lunar trajectory, which means that if you wanted to drop any cargo off, I mean, you could send something towards the moon. It's just going to hit it really effing fast.
Yeah, it will make a nice little crater.
That, yeah, you know. To try to land it, you have to then use, you know, you'd have to enter into an orbit and et cetera and do that, which, you know, not to say that couldn't be. I don't know what the mechanics are of that. So there is a lot. Bombarding the moon with comets was one of the proposals was to try to do that. They say it would take about 100 comets to do this. I don't know if they're size compared to planets like Mars and Venus. It would also take significantly less comets in order to accomplish this, an estimated 100 versus thousands. I guess they have a generalized idea of that.
Man, this is sounding smarter and smarter. Like start with the small scale fixer up.
But you know, the curious thing too, though, is that like I don't know how long these proposals were done since we've been learning a lot more about water on moon. You know, the moon may have far more water than we realize. And I don't know if we need to, you know, some of these articles I'm looking up on this, I don't know how up to date they are on that.
Dude, I'm in.
Well, they're only going to get smarter.
And your lunar day would be 28 days.
That'd be fine, right?
lot of sun.
I mean,
yeah, like, part of what they're talking about, like, is using the comets to also spin the moon to get up to like a 60-hour day. They need 100 comets the size of Halley's Comet, which would bring water and carbon dioxide, which is one of the things that we need on the moon.
It feels like getting the moon spinning at a regular rotation would have consequences for the orbital dynamics, but I'm sure smarter people than us have figured that out.
I don't know that it would. Would it?
I don't know. I don't know. This is why I'm dumb. This is why we're not the science show featuring three scientists. We're not mans of science. We're fans of science.
That, but anyhow, gentlemen, you guys, you want to,
ready? It's been 2 weeks. 2 weeks.
Little journey quest.
Journey quest.
When last.
When we last left our heroes, we had successfully invented gunpowder and bombs.
Right. Also, Brian tried to set up a swindle where
we had successfully fended off a attacking army, at which point Brian, without consulting Justin, immediately made an offer to the invading army that we would totally sell out the kingdom for which we were defending if only we got passage to where, you might ask. That was also left up
literally anywhere but here. Okay, first of all, relevant details. We definitely were just waiting for the axe to fall on our necks when they figured out that we'd actually killed.
You won the battle.
We did not win the battle. We won the first onslaught, and then they were coming from the other side, and we were out of everything. And second of all, also, we definitely murdered their duke. We murdered their
manslaughter,
as far as anyone knows. And I was impersonating
the
duke. We
also just invented gunpowder, and we're the only people that can keep inventing it.
Good point. Well, let's see what do the invading hordes say to our offer.
So your offer is gunpowder in exchange for passage.
Also, like, look at how much gunpowder. These are definitely not laundry bags full of laundry. They're definitely more of our demon seed. We'll give you so much demon seed as we're trademarking it.
Okay, I pull Brian aside. Brian.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So explain to me why selling these people out is better than us just seizing control of this kingdom and then ordering them to take us wherever we want.
Okay, you do remember that we were brought here against our will for the pleasure of the Duke, who was not a great guy, and he died, and I'm currently impersonating. That's why I'm wearing this armor. Like, what about any of this says you want to live here forever? Also, we're in the past. Yeah. This is garbage. Nobody knows about penicillin. There's a billion things that we can invent. Okay.
All I'm saying is that I would prefer perfect world here, blue sky, just yes and brainstorming.
Okay.
If there was ever a time to pull a coup on this kingdom, it is now when we are literal wizards who have created a miracle.
Okay.
Right?
Yes, and?
And we can spin the narrative that the Duke sent for us on his dying breath, knowing that we were needed to stop this invasion. The prophecy is now fulfilled. Take us wherever we want.
Okay. So, what do we do then? You're 100% right. I may have acted a little bit impetuously, but... Well, we got to get the hell out of here because we're in the past for some kind of reason, and we don't even know. We got to find out when we are, where we are. We got to get with the.
We don't even know if we're in the past, man. We could be getting Shemalian'd right now.
Could be
outside of Philadelphia.
We could be playing Assassin's Creed right this very minute and never know it. Look, I agree, but what I do know is that nobody in this castle seems to know. We've not met a single person that seems to know what's going on or what's possible for us. And I feel like you and I got to get on the road. And the moment they find out I'm not really the Duke, I think we're a little bit hosed.
Well, we got to make this a big splash then.
So blow up the castle.
Bring forward the guy. He got up from the other kingdom, okay. Right?
Yeah. All right. Excuse me, sir. Please come over here. We would like to involve you in our super secret meeting.
Oh, you're here to discuss terms of surrender. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. We would like for you to come and you're going to surrender. But you got to do it in front of everybody, so we all know what's happening. So
also, which one of us is surrendering, real quick? Because I know we're surrounded.
They are surrendering to us.
Why would they surround us and then surrender to us? That's
no. We chased them around. This was the last of their remnants, right?
Other people were doing war tactics.
battlefield strategy. I tell you, I have very different memories of memories of how this went.
I remember them as the invading forces as shattered in the face of our technological.
Yeah, I remember we held off the first wave and then they went around to the other side.
Yeah, they're swarming around the other side, but maybe Brian had piled a lot of gunpowder against the side of the castle.
Again, laundry in the shape of gunpowder, but yes.
All right. So,
I'm curious, what was that plan, by the way?
Oh, is this a switcheroo?
Yeah. The plan is you got to be able to point to a briefcase of what looks like money.
Think
right?
They weren't going to check that before they.
No, of course they weren't, man. They're afraid of demon seed. What? It's the best.
They have lying back then. Lying is still invented.
Look, well, I guess we'll never know, Bryce. We'll never know how it would have gone. Because
Envoy, who do you think is surrendering to who?
Well, I was pretty clear idea about that a few moments ago. Now I'm not so sure.
Listen, do you want to be partners? We will give you the recipe for demon seed, which is better branding than gunpowder.
We're going to transact. We bring you from our parlay in front of our people. We will officially surrender to you in front of our own people. So we walk and into our castle where everybody who's awaiting a siege now gazes upon us. I throw gunpowder on that guy and light him on fire.
Wait, which guy? Me?
The envoy.
The envoy.
Yes.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Enjoy life in the envoyed.
These are some very specific power plays in negotiation.
Well, the envoy was actually the nephew of the king that's invading.
Now he knows we're serious.
Yeah, it didn't play out so well. Because you've killed an envoy in the act of negotiating, that's like the worst act of war you can do.
Yeah.
And word's going to go out. Now you're going to have several other kingdoms that are going to decide that you have to be destroyed.
Mm, yeah, so it seems like you and I got to get out of Dodge.
Time to hit the bricks.
So, and the people of the dukedom that you're in, they watched you kill the envoy, and they're all going like, all right, what's your plan now?
I say, it's only fair.
Brian, that you understand, is in full armor, masquerading as the Duke still.
Right. I say, our envoy, have at him. Go.
He's not here. He called in sick today.
I wonder why.
He had some bad mashed potatoes. Just
all right.
How dead is the envoy that I just killed? Like totally dead, kind of dead.
He's still screaming. He's running around. Someone put him out.
Put him out.
Yeah,
please.
Go get a fire extinguisher.
He's covered in gunpowder lit alight. Dead. So. Justin, what's the plan?
This has kind of gotten a little confused now.
You're in the Great Hall. You're surrounded by all the captains, all the knights. They're in their armor.
Yeah.
They're kind of like, the envoy's like,
Yeah.
They're like, okay.
Okay, so here's the big headline. Surprise! We're not entertainers. We were sent for by the Duke. He was on his dying, his deathbed, and he said there's only one thing that can save this kingdom, and that's the bold leadership of us. You can just call us wizards. Let's go ahead.
Oh my God, he found the Duke's body under the bed.
Yes, okay. He died of natural causes, for the record.
He sent us, sent for us. Hey, also, I just lit a dude on fire, so let's just go ahead and make sure I'm A number one on the do not F with list. So watch your tone, guy who was yelling about the Duke's body. I came clean first. My partner here is not the Duke, but rather
I majestically take off my helmet and I puff my chest out and put my arms on my side and then gesture magnanimously as
this is
not
Brian,
their Duke.
I'm Justin, and you should know the value of the all-known Toyota RAV4.
So, two dozen men grab you. Bags are thrown over your heads. You're dragged into a courtyard violently, and you feel your necks pushed down onto carved little notches into stone blocks. And you hear the sound of what could be described as an axe being sharpened.
This does not sound like somebody who is A number one on the do not F with list, okay? Did you guys not see the part where we invented a new method to explosively take over the kingdom?
I pulled Justin aside. I'm like, hey, man, we're trying to brand it as Demon Seed.
No, you whisper over to Justin.
Yeah, you're whispering. We're both in the stocks.
Oh,
right
got
now.
It. Yeah. I lean over and I say Demon Seed. We'll call it Demon Seed.
All of the kingdoms are going to come unite and sack this castle. So either you let us go and we defend you, or you're all dead. How about that?
How about this plan? We're going to sever your heads, present them to the enemy army, and try to get the other ones not to invade. And we do have a bunch of your demon seed left around. We found in bags and bags this on the other side of the castle we're going to use.
Right. Well,
do you know how to activate it?
Yeah, you showed that to us when you set the envoy on fire and exploded him.
But how many of those bags are full of laundry?
We don't care how Demon Seed does and does not work.
Seems short-sighted. Seems real short-sighted on your part.
It seems like you're just going to run out of Demon Seed and you really need...
Any last wishes?
Yes. Yes. Let us go.
Next week on Journey Quest.
Didn't work out so hot. Sorry, Justin, I let you down.
Next week on the series finale of Journey Quest.
Oh my god. Somebody says, I'm late to the party. Is Demon Seed just another word for mayonnaise? Did they invent mayonnaise?
Hey, who's got picks?
I do, but I can't decide which one I love more and which one we should talk about now between Get Out and Logan. Have you seen either?
No.
I've not seen either. No. Oh. I was going to go see Logan, and then I wound up getting waylaid on Thursday, and then I spent the weekend in Syracuse. So there was not a whole lot of time to go see a movie.
Well, I love both of them. They're both very, very good. I think Logan I loved much, much more. But they're both very good for very, very different reasons, and you should see both, Logan and Get Out. And if you're not going to go see those and just want to have them ruined, then settle for the new Half in the Bag episode where they talk about those two movies.
Or Spoiling Time, where we'll probably talk about both of them, the show that we do.
Yeah, I've heard great things about Logan and the being told, see it before they spoil it for you. So
I
have a pick. You ever listen to an audiobook that's like so good and like I like you're like, I'm just gonna go to bed early and listen to my audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like,
I'm gonna take the long way home just so I could drive a little bit longer and hear another chapter.
Yeah, exactly. And one of my favorite books of all time, when people ask me my favorite book, one of the books I cite is Dune by Frank Herbert. And I've read this book multiple times. It's a book I've read more than any other book. And I decided on Audible that I would check out the Audible full cast version of that.
Wait, wow. So it's the actual text of the book, but all the different characters are played by different people?
For the most part. You know, there's one narrator who does a number of them, but there's a lot of other people play different parts of it. And it is fantastic. It is really well done. They've got a little bit of music in the background. It's an amazing production. And I've... it breathes new life into something I felt like I've seen multiple times, watched the movie and all that, and I'm really thoroughly enjoying it. So right now, my pick is the full cast production of Dune. And they actually did, I think they did the same thing for, I think they did it for Dune Messiah and Children of Dune. I think they did a few more of them. So I'm looking forward to that. Not all of the Frank Herbert Dune books have the full cast productions, but a number of them do.
Awesome.
I am going to pick a movie that I watched on the plane last night. It was calling to me on the United, watch the movies on your phone library, because a couple months ago, kept getting phone calls from one of the people on this very podcast every day. First telling me about this movie and then asking every day subsequently, did you watch Hunt for the Wilder People yet? Did you watch Hunt for the Wilder People yet? And so I can proudly report that I have now seen Hunt for the Wilder People. And man, I got to say, especially with all the Oscar talk, I'm annoyed this movie didn't get more attention. And I think it was better than almost any other movie that I saw. I loved it so much. And this is the same director that's going to be doing Thor Ragnarok. The way that the characters are done, man, the first 15 minutes of this movie, which at times can be very silly and you know, like halfway offensive, from characters that are deeply relatable, is so well done. You tell such a story within 15 minutes that everything that happens afterward is so, so, so resonant. I can't recommend this movie highly enough.
Is it it looks from the poster art like a documentary or something, but this is a fiction movie, right?
Oh yeah, no. This is Taika Waititi, who did What We Do in Shadows. It stars Sam Neill as an old a New Zealand bush drifter, and who's the name of the kid?
Julian Dennison.
Yeah, Julian Dennison is just great. He is just kind of magnetic, and that's so hard to do with kid actors. But you know, one of those movies where the relatability is really what just keeps bringing you into it, and it you know, can very often be a little silly and goofy. Obviously, some of the DNA that kind of made Flight of the Conchords is certainly in there. Taika Waititi was somebody else that, you know, directed a lot of those episodes.
Oh, wow.
But highly, highly, highly recommended. It is great. If you don't believe me and you don't believe Andrew, Mikey Newman put it in his top five movies of 2016. And I think with good cause. It was exceptional.
It is. It's, and I was hounding you on it because I'm like, it's a movie that didn't get as much fanfare as other stuff. And for a lot of other movies that came out last year that had got a lot of attention, this is easily one of my favorite movies from last year. It's just so good, such good care. And just if you want entertaining too, if you appreciate well-crafted, well-structured movies with great characters and stuff, and then it's perfect Sam Neill. And it's just a really a lovely film. So
I almost don't even want to, like, the first 50 minutes is just it's so good that if the comparison that I want to make kind of gives it away, but
don't give it up.
It's like, you know, in the same way that Up kind of like gave you this like backstory with your main character.
Did you see how I said don't give it up?
Oh, I thought you said give it up.
No, I said don't give it up.
Oops, that's my bad. Sorry, Skype.
It shares a lot of DNA with, you know, the kid and grumpy old man kind of thing. There is a similarity between it and Up and that, and that cantankerous old man and kid and all that. But it just, and I never once when I watched it did I even think about that because it's such its own movie.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No. And really, the biggest thing that you can say is that you care. You give a rat's ass about every single character. You know, even the ones that are kind of like silly in one note have more of a point to latch onto. And to be honest with you, I think that was something that was as well made as La La Land and Moonlight are. they're not the easiest characters to kind of latch onto, you know? And I think that this movie has that in spades.
I think, and that's one of the signs I think I like about Taika Waititi's characters is that everybody grows. Every character he has in his movies, whether it's What We Do in Shadows or this, is people you don't expect to have more depth to them, get more depth. Everybody gets more depth. Instead of getting to the end where you're like, yep, that's everything I need to know about them. You're like, oh, everybody has depth, even the bad people. You know, you're like, there's just this. And that's why I'm so excited about Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Right on.
Boom. That it?
I think so. I guess everything else goes into after things. Do me a favor, everybody. Go see Logan. Go see Get Out.
Yeah, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Chapter 1. Enraptured. When she saw the telephone pole with the yellow plastic base again, Olivia Fletcher slammed on the brakes of her mail truck, bringing it to a skidding halt. She checked the postal computer GPS on the dashboard one more time. It still insisted this was the intersection. But that was impossible. There was supposed to be a gas station and mini-mart at the corner. She remembered the old man who sat behind the counter, and the two mutts that would slobber on her ankles when she'd stop by to get her bottle of Diet Shasta. The lot was now just dirt, scattered with rocks. It was hard to even call it a lot. The land blended into the rest of the landscape. As she stared out at the empty plot, perplexed, a dust-filled breeze blew into the cab, forcing her to roll up the window. This had been her route 2 years ago. She was positive she'd passed the station only a couple of weeks back on her way to Runyon. Charlie, the carrier who normally had this route, hadn't mentioned anything about the station or the old man going away. There was no property for sale sign or anything else indicating it had been torn down. Of course, Charlie also hadn't said anything about skipping town a few days back, leaving her to take over. Deciding the postal computer GPS was lying, Olivia pulled out her phone to check Google Maps. There was barely one bar of signal. All things considered, she thought herself lucky to get even that much in the Colorado high desert. The map slowly loaded on her phone. In league with the postal computer, it insisted this was the right turnoff. Well, heck, Olivia muttered, then turned the truck down the dirt road toward Moffett. Maybe somebody there could tell her what happened to the station. The last time she'd driven through Moffett, it had been a collection of paint-stripped houses and a trailer park where people had kept to themselves. They all seemed a little churchy to her. They weren't Mormon fundamentalists or anything as far as she knew, just folks who liked to be left alone. Based on the landscape and the shape of the ridge she was driving toward, Olivia was certain this was the road to Moffett after all. Except there was no farmhouse and run-down shack like she remembered. It was just open plain on either side, with patches of weeds and stunted trees half petrified from the dry air. She reached the top of the ridge that overlooked Moffett, but there was no town to see. Even the road, covered in dirt and gravel, was only partially visible. It was the only sign people had ever been here, and barely at that. It reminded her of one of those atomic bomb test sites out in Nevada, after the bomb had gone off. She drove the truck to the exact spot her postal computer GPS said was the center of Moffett and put it in park. She found herself in the center of nothing. Hell, she grumbled, shaking her head. Bracing against the grit-filled wind, Olivia slid open her door and stepped onto the road. She shielded her eyes with a tanned hand and looked for some trace of the town. If this was Moffett, there should have been a row of houses to her left, a garage and a laundromat to her right, and a small grocery store next to the Farm Services building straight ahead. Olivia remembered the name of the woman who worked the grocery store counter. Eunice. She had an orange tabby cat that sat on the counter like a pudgy king, demanding to be petted by everyone who entered. But there was no store. No Eunice. No pudgy cat. Olivia pulled strands of hair from her eyes and wiped away the dust that kept coming. The trailer park where Eunice lived should have been at the end of the street. Now it seemed the trailer park only existed in Olivia's memory. She glanced back at the bundle of mail in her truck, which she was supposed to leave at the P.O. box in the store. That wasn't going to happen. What was she supposed to do? There was no way around it. She felt foolish. But she'd already spent 2 hours going up and down the road that led to the Moffitt turnoff. Suppressing an expletive, she dialed her son-in-law, a deputy sheriff in Cooper. He'd be able to straighten this out. The two got along well and often talked several times a day. "What's up, Olivia?" he casually asked. "Eric, this is gonna sound stupid, hun. I don't want you thinking your mother-in-law has lost it." "You kill somebody?" he joked. "Not exactly." His tone suddenly got serious. "What's going on?" "I lost a town." A long pause. "Moffitt?" There was no trace of surprise in his voice. Olivia froze. "Yeah. How'd you know?" "I got a man with a produce truck in front of me asking the same thing. Hold on, I'm getting something over the radio." Olivia kicked the toe of her shoe into the dirt while she waited for him to finish. There was something metal under the dust. Curious, she knelt down for a closer look. "Well, that's odd," Eric said, returning to their call. "The telephone exchange says all the numbers appear disconnected. I haven't heard of any recent tornado reports. I better call the sheriff. Any idea how many people live out there?" 58, she replied without missing a beat. "You know that off the top of your head?" Olivia swept her hand across the metal sign at her feet. It said, "Welcome to Moffitt, population 58. She read it aloud over her phone, then said, "Eric, I think the town is flat out gone."
"Gone?
No people?" "Gone as in not here. No people? No town." Olivia stood up and felt cold. "Gone." The word echoed in her head as she tried to imagine the town as it once was. The buildings. The people. The sun was setting, and the shadows were growing longer. She noticed bits of charred, broken boards poking out of the dirt. A cracked cinder block stuck out of the ground like a giant, chipped tooth. She was taken back to the stories in high school history class about ancient cities buried under the dirt. One day, the people just covered everything and left. Nobody knew why. She climbed back into the truck and locked the door as the wind grew stronger. Either something took these people and their town, or they went willingly, erasing every trace of their existence. She wasn't sure which scenario scared her more.
Chapter 2. Death's Door. Dressed in an acris pantsuit, with platinum blonde hair, high cheekbones, and a slim nose, both crafted by a high-end Beverly Hills plastic surgeon, Diane McGillis looks more like a model turned K Street lobbyist than a serial killer as she turns the key to the door of the townhouse that houses her office, located a few blocks from the White House. It's 9:47 a.m., which means she's just finished her Pilates class and stopped by a juice bar on her way to work for her kale cleanser shake. My unkempt hair pulled back in a tie, I'm in jeans and an unwashed sweater, sipping a three-hour-old Starbucks latte and wishing I had time to make it to the gym, much less do a load of laundry or even shower. I glance at the half-empty cups and fast food containers scattered around the monitors and cameras set up in our rented loft across the street from McGillis's office. I guess I should clean those up. I guess I should be doing a lot of things. Right now, what I'm really wishing for is a break in the McGillis case. She's not your typical serial killer, and her victims and their families, hell, most of the FBI, don't see her for what she is. I'd had to call in a few favors to even get this investigation going. One of the conditions of the surveillance operation was that I would work the crap shifts so others in the detail could spend normal hours with their families. "Has she done the egg trick?" my grandfather asks over speakerphone. I'm watching McGillis while my grandfather rummages through old files in the basement of his ramshackle mansion in Los Angeles. I'd forgotten he was even on the line. "The egg bag? She's not doing kitty shows, Grandpa." The egg bag is pretty much what it sounds like. An egg made of wood and a small velvet bag. The egg goes in the bag and it vanishes. The magician will turn the bag inside out to prove the egg isn't there. It's actually more impressive than it sounds in the right hands. Grandfather, one of the last magic greats, could have an audience rolling in the aisles while he made a hapless volunteer search in vain for the egg. This was a far cry from McGillis's performance. Her volunteers tended to die. He sighs, exasperated. "No, no, the gypsy egg thing." "What's that?" "It's supposed to be a purifying ritual. The medium tells the client to bring a fresh chicken egg to a session. They rub the egg all over the client's body, then ask the client to crack it open. Inside, there's blood, hair, other putrid things. The client is duped because they brought the egg." I adjust a tripod to get a better view through a gap in the loft's curtains. "And the medium switches it for a prepared one when they're not looking?" I reply.
"Yes. You can hide the seal with super glue. Sometimes they do the switch right behind their back, or they use an accomplice. Does this witch have a helper?"
"Yeah," I reply, leaning in to look through the telescope aimed at McGillis's window. I can see she's talking to her assistant, Leo Martine. He's rail thin, in his late 20s, and nearly as well-dressed as McGillis. "I'm looking at him. Mousy kind of guy. Went to Vassar. We're not sure if he's in on it."
"He has to be," Grandfather replies. "He's the one doing all the dirty work for her. Have any of the victims come forward yet?"
"No. We're trying to build a list of clients by watching who comes in and out of the place. Maybe one of them will help us out."
"You can always send me," Grandfather offers.
"I may have to take you up on that." If I didn't know any better, I'd say his offer sounds genuinely sincere. Of course, I have to keep in mind, he's a professional faker who has spent countless hours staring into a mirror perfecting his skills as a liar. However, over the last year, I have to admit that things have improved between us. Either he's become less of a bastard, or I've become a little more of one and can give it right back to him. We've always had an awkward relationship, to put it mildly. I left home as soon as I could, mainly to get out of his shadow. Technically, I left Mexico City. It was on the night I almost drowned while performing an escape he'd engineered on international television. I wasn't really sure if he'd have been upset with the outcome, as long as it got him enough publicity. My dad, bless his heart, was always more of an older brother to me than a father. He was young when I was born, and still very much my grandfather's son. My mother didn't stick around long enough to make an impression on me. I used to imagine that I took after her, projecting whatever qualities I wanted on my made-up version of her. I blamed grandfather for her absence. Despite his present helpfulness, when I was growing up, he was an overbearing bastard who would cut my father and uncle down right in front of me. Nothing was ever good enough for him. Now I realize he was projecting his own insecurities on everyone around him. Not that this makes his behavior right, but as I got older,
I saw what real evil was. Grandfather growled a lot and said mean things, but when it came down to it, he's always been there when I've needed him. Learning to ask for his help has been the hardest part. Diane McGillis, on the other hand, is one of the evilest sociopaths I've ever encountered. She's set herself up in Washington, D.C. as a spiritualist, but besides reading fortunes for bored politicians' wives and neurotic lobbyists, she also masquerades as a holistic healer, offering medical advice and prescribing unproven, if not flat-out fake, remedies. But this isn't the truly sinister part of her enterprise, or the reason I hate her with a passion. Her specialty is victimizing people in the late stages of cancer. McGillis performs crystal healing ceremonies, dispenses special teas, and offers a grab bag full of other claptrap options tailored to each victim's belief system, none of which come cheap. She befriends them, earns their trust, gets them to make her a life insurance beneficiary via some bogus spiritual charitable organization she controls, and then manipulates them into stopping chemotherapy or any other form of conventional treatment that might really save their lives. She gives them false comfort with a soothing quilt of lies, a contrast to the cold, hard reality of cancer specialists and hospitals. When her bullshit fails to help them and they pass away, she collects on the insurance policies. She empties their bank accounts on the way to the grave and then hits the jackpot when they die. They think she's a friend, even to the point of getting her victims to alienate their families and loved ones. A skilled manipulator, she knows all the right triggers to press. She's led at least 4 people to their deaths so far. Who knows how many others she conned before showing up in the Capitol 18 months ago. The $20,000 she pays for rent every month has to come from somewhere. It's sick. She picks on people at their most vulnerable. The hardest part is explaining to the victims' families that the person their loved one trusted, who provided so much comfort during the final stages of their loved one's life, was actually hastening their deaths for personal gain. McGillis's mistake was the choice of her most recent victim, the wife of a sitting senator. He was bitter about the money she'd been paying to McGillis while his wife was alive, and even angrier when he found out after her death that McGillis was a beneficiary. McGillis probably just saw this wealthy woman as an ideal target. But had she done her research, she would have learned that Senator Foster is a member of the Senate Committee on Appropriations and in charge of appropriating funding for the U.S. Department of Justice. It's sad that this is what it took for McGillis to appear on our radar, and that's the way things work in this city.
Has she done any psychic surgery? Grandfather asks.
Popular in the Philippines and South America, psychic surgery involves a so-called healer pretending to make magical incisions in someone's body to remove tumors without cutting the skin. Actually, they're using sleight-of-hand techniques to produce bloody chicken guts. It sounds ridiculous, but thousands of people seek this out, believing it's a viable alternative to the cost and pain of actual surgery or terminal diagnosis. Even famous, otherwise intelligent people like Peter Sellers and Andy Kaufman fall for the scam out of desperation. Back when I went to the University of Miami, I once used the principle of psychic surgery to remove a card from a guy's stomach during a college psychology class presentation. I'll never forget his high-pitched scream when he looked down and saw all the blood. I'd thought he was kind of cute. Not after that. Not that I know of, I reply. She mainly lights candles and waves crystals around.
You seeing anybody special?
Grandfather asks out of nowhere. I ignore the question. We're in a good place right now, but I'm not at the point where I'm ready to talk to him about the men in my life, or the lack thereof. We might send one of our agents in. There's a woman in narcotics with a treatable lymphoma. She's recovering, but still looks underweight.
Your father is up for the Academy of Magical Arts Lecturer of the Year,
he says, trying again to take the conversation into personal territory. Do you know anything about candle magic? I reply.
I'm still thinking about my grandfather's psychic surgery question. Remembering the relighting candles and the ones with colored flames I played with in my room as a little girl. They looked almost like a living thing, not a blatant magic trick. McGillis's clientele are largely too sophisticated for psychic surgery and gypsy stunts, but might be persuaded by something like that.
You can scry with a candle.
Scry? Like, see into the future?
Yes, or just see images. Stare at a candle long enough and you'll hallucinate. There was a yogi out here who was running an ashram in the basement of a producer at Paramount. He used to get people high on mushrooms and then have them stare into the flame.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about a drug angle.
You should think about coming to the award show for your father. He's got a new girlfriend, by the way.
That's great, I say without any additional comment. I really want to avoid another conversation about my own personal life. My mind is racing on to something else. Ever hear about a healer using a hallucinogen in a tea? McGillis could be adding a little extra kick, like ayahuasca to her herbal tea bags. We might be able to get a felony drug charge this way. That would be something at least.
You're kidding. Out here in LA, I can't imagine what they haven't tried.
There's a knock at the loft's front door. I ignore it, even though our cover story is that I'm a software consultant renting a room from two other freelancers. Our policy for this stakeout is to not answer the door if we can avoid it. McGillis and Martine move out of view. If she is using some kind of drug in her therapy sessions, her assistant would probably be the one procuring it. If we can catch him red-handed, we might be able to turn him against her. A few years ago, I never would have thought about prosecuting a case like this that way. My boss, Dr. Ailes, says I'm learning to think laterally. Another knock. I check the monitor for the hallway camera, which is aimed at the door. A young woman in a blouse and jacket, holding a small bundle in her arms, is standing there. Underneath her red hair and dark, almost black lipstick, she looks distressed. I wrap my fingertips across the table, debating if I should answer the door. McGillis isn't visible at the moment, but I don't want to step away. I decide to keep ignoring the woman, hoping she'll give up. She knocks again. Damn it, I grumble.
Something wrong?
Grandfather asks. I'll call you later. I hang up and grab my University of Miami hat and nerd girl glasses. The woman knocks a fourth time.
Hold on,
I call out, tucking my sidearm into the waistband of my jeans under my sweater. I unlatch the door, pretending to wipe sleep from my eyes, and the woman gives me a small smile. She adjusts the weight of the bundle in her arms. She seems to be holding a baby.
Hello, neighbor. I was wondering if I could talk to you for a moment.
I don't recall seeing her around. She could be someone's guest.
I'm sorry, I'm a little busy, I reply, forcing a smile, trying not to be too terse.
She's pale. Her red hair is pulled tightly into a bun, and plainly visible around her neck is a chain necklace made of red links. I try to get a glimpse of the baby's face, but she's holding it tightly to her chest.
I just have a question, she says.
The cop in me decides to take the upper hand by responding to a question with a question.
Boy or girl?
I ask. Without looking down, she replies,
girl.
Her tone is almost lyrical, her words spilling out like a well-rehearsed song.
Have you noticed how turbulent things have been lately in the world?
Oh, great. A religious freak.
Not really,
I reply, trying to shut her off. Grandfather would have said he was a ghost and told her to go away.
Well, I'm here to tell you about your personal salvation.
She absent-mindedly raises an arm, letting the baby almost slip. I saved the Pope,
I think to myself. What more do I need to do to get salvation? This conversation got real nutty real quick. I'm sorry, but I don't have time to talk about Jesus right now. I'm about to shut the door, but I keep staring at the bundle. Her baby is quiet. I haven't seen her stir once. Even swaddled, she seems so small. I'm not here to talk about Jesus. The woman's eyes bore into me. Then who? Cthulhu? No? The woman reaches into the blankets, and I catch my first glimpse of the baby's face. She's blue. She's so unnaturally blue. I don't see the woman pull something shiny from the folds of the blanket. I'm here for your soul, Jessica, she snarls, raising a knife into the air. Instinct kicks in. I grab for the infant and kick the woman hard in the stomach. As she falls backward against the hallway wall, the child begins to slide from her arms. My left arm reaches out and catches her. My right hand goes for my gun. The woman looks up at me, rage in her eyes. Drop the knife, I shout, pointing my pistol at her chest. She gets to her feet and glares at me, trying to figure out what to do next. I'm trying to keep the baby from slipping out of my grasp, and while I can't disarm the woman without dropping the child, I could shoot her. It's coming, Jessica! She screams, and then she runs away down the hallway. There's no time to worry about how she knows my name. I want to give chase, but I have this child in my arms. I glance down. Glassy eyes stare up at me. Red veins feather her bluish skin. This baby isn't breathing.